So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy Mother's Day. What could be more fundamental than motherhood? Motherhood and apple pie, as they say in America. It's primal. We are said to carry mitochondrial DNA in our cells. Do people know what mitochondrial DNA is? It's not the DNA in our nucleus that divides. It's floating around in the rest of the cell, outside the nucleus. And it is said that it is passed down. It is known that it is passed down only through the female line, and it has been traced back to a common the oldest common female ancestor, who has been dubbed the mitochondrial Eve, goes back at least 100,000 years, probably more. Some of us here have given birth, and some have not. Some of us here have witnessed a birth. Many have not. How many have witnessed a birth? A human birth. Yeah, see, not that many. You know, it's not, even though childbirth is changed a lot over the years, still many of us, many go through life without having witnessed a birth. And it's a powerful thing to witness a living being emerging from another being's body. Sometimes with a tremendous and painful and even dangerous labor. And when we're the one being born, it's our first experience of being propelled into a world that is other than us. It's our first experience of me and the world. Although, as little babies, we don't quite get that yet. It comes gradually, that sense of separation, and how that comes about affects how we feel about separation. And but it's the way our, what we call self, starts to get constructed, right from the beginning. Now, I haven't witnessed a human birth, and I haven't given birth myself, but I've witnessed a lot of animal births. Because in my early 20s, I lived on an organic farm in the back-to-the-land days. It was in the Maritime Provinces. It was in New Brunswick. And I raised goats and sheep. I suspect that the switch to upright walking on two legs did not do human women a favor when it comes to childbirth. The does and ewes, that's what you call them, female goats and sheep, usually were quite nonchalant about the process of giving birth. They might lean on the wall of their little stall, or not even, some would just stand up and grunt a few times and the little ones would come sliding out. I would clear its mouth and cut its cord. And usually you didn't have to cut the cord, it would just break if they came. If they dropped, but you'd try and catch them. In a few moments, they would shake their heads, their little wet heads, and scramble to their feet and search for their mother's udder, kind of tottering on their little legs. Sometimes the mother would help nudging them along. That's when all went well. But sometimes a particularly big lamb or kid would get stuck, or twins or triplets would get tangled. And I would have to help, because I was the one with the narrowest hand. Now, a typical doe, or ewe, is about the weight, very close to the weight of a human woman. And their babies are 5 to 10 pounds, just like ours. So there's something very familiar and intimate about the scale of things when you help them. So I'd have to wait until just after a contraction, and then gently reach inside and picture what I was feeling and visualize. Now, what it's supposed to be is two hooves and a nose lined up like this as they're about to dive out into the world. That's how they come. But sometimes what you find is one leg and you can't find the other, it's back here. So you have to reach in around that shoulder and just with a finger hook it and pull it back out. And you have to pause for another contraction to go by and then pull it carefully out until they're lined up. Or sometimes what's even harder is if the head is turned like that and you feel the side of the head, you might feel a little ear. So then you have to reach back and kind of hook the nose and gently pull it forward until it's lined up. Or if there's twins or triplets tangled up, you have to sort out all those legs. And maybe you have to gently push one back so the other one can come and get lined up. There's something tremendously exhilarating about that release, that successful entry into the world of a new being. Yes. That first cry or first bleat. So no wonder the BBC series called Call the Midwife has become such a hit. Okay, is anyone a fan? Confess. Yeah, see.
Season one.
You're still in season one. It gets better. It's about a team of midwives. Some of them are nuns, and some of them are nurses, nurse midwives, who serve a poor working class part of post-World War II London. And it's all about compassion. They do a really good job, and now they're into the early 60s. It's progressed. But birth is just the beginning, right? For humans, it's a long haul to raise a child to adulthood. And these days, fairly often, young adult children come boomeranging back for a few years. So you have to be prepared for that. And there are increasing numbers of grandparents, for various reasons, taking on the raising of young children. So it takes a committed, loving parent, or two, or more, and grandparents, an extended family, a neighborhood, a community, a healthy society, a world free from war and dislocation, and clean food, water, and air, and good shelter, all that, you know, to raise healthy children. So motherhood is awesome. It's something to celebrate and honor. And yet motherhood is also a little complicated. And in our culture, in these times, it's easy to celebrate Mother's Day if you have a warm connection with your mother, particularly if she's nearby. But if she's far away, you might feel a little homesick for her. You might miss her. And if there's some kind of estrangement or tension in your relationship, you might feel some ambivalence about Mother's Day, you know, some wishing that it was different. And if your mother has died, whether recently or years ago, there are feelings about that that come on Mother's Day. The way you miss her still, the way you miss her love, or the way that when she died, the hope of ever receiving the care and acceptance you always wished for ended too. That happens. And yet, there's a way that that relationship continues to evolve. As we go through life, our relationship to our mothers changes, whether they're living or not. We have to rework that relationship with our mothers. My own mother used to tell the story of how devastated she felt when her own mother died during the Great Depression in the 30s, when she was about 12, my mom was, with four siblings. And she told us, she would tell the story of how she went to Sunday school on Mother's Day, and every child was given a rose to take home to their mother, and she didn't get one because she didn't have a mother anymore. She never forgot that. Maybe she has now. Maybe you are a little more sensitive to issues of inclusivity these days. I was listening to the CBC the other day, and I heard of an elementary school out in Mission, which is where Michael and I live, that had caused something of a stir by announcing that they would no longer be having the children make Mother's Day and Father's Day presents in school out of consideration for children who had non-traditional families. You know, what if that child didn't have a mother or a father in the home, or had two mothers or two fathers, or was being raised by grandparents because dad's in prison and, you know, mom's an addict. I wonder if eventually we'll make a single day to celebrate and honor parents. How would that be? Or if our ideas of what mothering and fathering are will remain too distinct for that. I don't know. We all have the capacity for caring and nurturing, for unconditional love, regardless of gender. There's a hormone called oxytocin, which has become popularly known as the love hormone, and it's produced at high levels in nursing mothers. But it also has plays a role in not just mother-child bonding, but social bonding and nurturing behaviors, you know, for couples and beyond, you know, grandma, grandpas and their grandchildren, in both men and women and in non-human social animals. Grooming, kissing, and hugging stimulate oxytocin. Release and generate the pleasant, relaxed feelings and trusting feelings that we associate with caring touch. Michael and I recently saw film footage of a large male chimpanzee adopting and tenderly caring for a little orphaned chimpanzee baby. He was a year old, so he probably actually could survive with care. The whole world is in desperate need of our care. The children of the world, the other than human beings of the world, and the earth systems, the complex earth systems upon which our lives depend. But the trouble is that oxytocin also reinforces our tribal conditioning. They did studies of showing people the American flag with and without oxytocin. It made a difference. So it can reinforce our tribal conditioning, you know, to extend care to those we identify with as my family, my race, my ethnicity, my nationality, etc., and not to those outside our sphere of care and compassion. So our practice, if we take up the Bodhisattva path over a lifetime or lifetimes, is to grow our capacity to care, our sphere of care and compassion beyond what we identify with as me and mine. Without clinging, with a heart as wide as the world, to borrow the phrase of Vipassana teacher Sharon Salzberg, a heart as wide as the world. And then there's a poem by a Japanese monk, Ryokan, 18th century monk, may my priest robe be wide enough to shelter all the suffering beings of the world. Reminds me of that too. Dogen Zenji, who founded our stream of Zen in Japan, brought it from China, Soto Zen from China to Japan, talks about this capacity in, interestingly enough, his instructions to the cook called Tenzo Kyokun. The Zen cook is called a Tenzo. Dogen tells us that the way we handle the ingredients and the tools of preparing food with attention and with care is kind of a template for how to live in the world. And he describes three capacities of mind to bring to our tasks of preparing food, nourishing others, whatever we do. Parental mind, joyful mind, and big mind, or spacious mind. The first, Roshin, in Japanese, is translated sometimes as parental mind, sometimes it's called Robashin, or grandmother mind. But that ro, the first syllable, doesn't actually mean parent, it's more like elder. It's the same as Roshi, which means elder teacher. So it's the calm, loving, patient mind of an elder that we express with that parental mind, rather not the mind of a kind of immature, self-focused, and anxious parent. And we all, of course, have that kind of parent in us as well. Here's what Dogen had to say about Roshin, parental mind, or the mind of an elder. Roshin is the mind or attitude of a parent. In the same way that a parent cares for an only child, keep the three treasures in your mind, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. A parent, irrespective of poverty or difficult circumstances, loves and raises a child with care, but not always, as we know. How deep is love like this? Only a parent can understand it. A parent protects the children from the cold and shades them from the hot sun with no concern for his or her own personal welfare. Only a person in whom this mind has arisen can understand it, and only one in whom this attitude has become second nature can fully realize it. In this same manner, when you handle water, rice, or anything else, you must have the affectionate and caring concern of a parent raising a child. But as I mentioned, you know, we can bring our anxieties and our insecurities to parenting and to our other work in the world. Parental mind can become all-consuming, become obsessive and even unbalanced if we feel we have to be in control all the time. There are so many factors in children's lives these days. You know, so many of them unwholesome and so many demands on parents' time and attention. So often I've had mothers ask me, well, if in Buddhist practice we're supposed to let go of attachment, how am I supposed to take care of my children? Good question. Now this is particularly hard when our child is suffering. What, am I supposed to feel non-attached when my child is suffering? Well, of course, and particularly when children are young, we do everything we can to ease or alleviate their suffering. Of course we take care of them. But when a child is an adult and engaged in self-destructive behavior, that's a little different and harder. It's very painful to witness, but we can have limited ability to intervene effectively. So this is kind of the crux of bodhisattva practice, isn't it? We need to respond to children, to our children, to other children, to the world around us, with the utmost attention and care, but without clinging. Without clinging. We have to let go again and again of our agenda and our attachment to results. We're having things go the way we think they should. You know, to have that child become the doctor or the lawyer or the, you know, what we would most like them to be. And ultimately we let go, we let our children go out into their own adulthood while maintaining a warm connection as best we can. Sometimes, tragically, we even have to let them go into illness, addiction, even death beyond our control. This is the hardest life event for a parent to face. But it happens. And at times like that, we have to call on our inner and outer elders, our grandfather and grandmother, and I don't mean necessarily familial, to help us through. The other time we need to call on our inner elders is when the time comes that we have to say goodbye to our mother, to release her into illness or death. If this comes prematurely, as I mentioned it did for my own mother, when you're still a child or a young adult, there's a way that you have to let her go, as I mentioned again and again, as you enter each stage of your own life. And at the same time, there's a way that your relationship with her and its meaning continues to evolve beyond death. On the other hand, if you're someone like me, whose mother lives to a great age, my mom's 93, and I just spent most of last month with her, you must turn towards releasing her after she's lived a long life, and you must sometimes witness the deterioration of her capabilities of body, mind, and memory. She may seem to regress and be childish or childlike, but she knows and resents it if someone treats her like a child. You must be present with her with the utmost caring, patience, and openness to her experience, just as it is each day, each moment. You must let go of your wishes for her attention and affirmation and simply love her with your elder mind, your Roshin, your unconditional love. And sometimes when her memories of old hurts and grievances drops away with memory loss, you can meet your mother in the spacious present in moments of great sweetness and joy. So I would go out for wonderful bird walks early in the morning, and then I'd come back and I'd say, "Mom, I saw so many cardinals and goldfinches and the bluebirds are back." She'd say, and her face would just light up, and she'd say, "Oh, how about that?" We spend a lot of time just sitting. She's in nursing care in there, and she's wheelchair and bedbound. Her world has shrunk from the bed to the wheelchair, out to the dining room and back, and if it's a nice day, out to the patio and back. And she doesn't remember where she and my dad lived for the last 10 years or where... just down the hall, the partial nursing care unit where she spent the last 2 years before she fell recently. But if you take her down that hall and she sees people's faces, she just brightens right up and is happy to see the people she knew there. So we spent a lot of time just sitting, looking out her window at the spring flowers coming and the wide lawn. And then she'd say, what's that pink over there? That's a pink dogwood. A pink dogwood? Yes, remember we had a white one when we lived up on the hill. Yeah. Well, there are pink ones too, and white ones. And they're in full bloom all over right now. Well, I'll be darned. And then 10 minutes later, what's that pink over there? That's a pink dogwood. We'd have the same conversation. So it became like a little, I don't know, like a little song or a little poem or something. And one day we were sitting there and looking out the window and she said, I'm just noticing the astonishment. And I said, so am I. To meet the great matter of life and death, not to turn away from suffering around us, we also need the other two capacities Dogen mentions. Joyful mind, which is kishin, is an attitude of gratitude for our lives. Gratitude that we've been born into circumstances that allow us to practice at all. Lots of people can't even begin to take a step towards paying attention to their lives. Rather than focusing on our deficits, which we're all prone to do, we appreciate life's simple gifts. That pink dogwood. And we offer our lives just as they are. You know, with all our imperfections. We offer them to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And we do that by simply paying attention to our lives. And how we do what we do. Whether it's growing vegetables, preparing a meal, caring for children, teaching, healing, repairing, building, organizing, making art. The list of human activities is endless. And then there are times in our lives when our offering is to receive support from others. That's my mom's offering now. She can't do anything other than just crack a joke with the nurse, and that brightens their day. To receive support from others with grace and joy. And then the third capacity is called Daishin, big mind. I kind of like to call it spacious mind. One translator calls it magnanimous mind. This is the mind of equanimity. Dogen says it's like a mountain, stable and impartial. It supports our bodhisattva activity of caring from the spacious perspective of our boundless nature. From this perspective that sees deeply the impermanence and conditioned nature of all phenomena. This is what we mean in Buddhist and Zen practice by emptiness. You'll hear that word and we'll chant it in the Heart Sutra in a few minutes. It's a dynamic interconnectedness. It's not void. It's dynamic with possibility. The Heart Sutra, which many of you are familiar with, but not everybody, is it's only less than a page long, but it's a distillation of much longer texts called the Prajnaparamita texts, or Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. There are different ones, but one is called the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines. And in it, this perfection of wisdom and compassion based on deep insight into emptiness is personified as a mother or source who gives birth to Buddhas. Here she is. That's her. You don't see images of her very often, actually. And within that long sutra is a passage called Hymn to the Perfection of Wisdom, and we're going to chant that today. We usually only chant it at retreats, but we're going to chant it today because it's invoking this mother of all Buddhas, this perfection of wisdom and compassion. In a sense, this image, this mother image, represents the matrix of interconnection that spans space and time, within which all phenomena arise and pass away. And in apprehending this reality, we let go of clinging and aversion, and wisdom and compassion are born. I was thinking our practice is, in a way, a kind of labor for us to be born into our true being. Sometimes it really feels like a labor. It feels like we are giving it our strongest, fiercest effort. And like labor, sometimes we have to let go of our resistance and allow it to happen through us. Let go of control. With this big mind, spacious mind, we can let go of the push and pull of the eight worldly winds, what are called the eight worldly winds. I love that expression. Pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. Right? We're always getting tossed about in the wind, one way or another, by these eight worldly winds. So we don't want one and we want the other. We don't want blame, but we do like praise. Right. Dogen says, "Do not get carried away by the sounds of spring, nor become heavy-hearted upon seeing the colors of fall. View the changes of the seasons as a whole, and weigh the relativity of light and heavy from a broad perspective." So when we truly understand and actualize this spacious mind, we are free from fear, free from hindrance, and we can respond to the suffering we encounter, not only in our own family, our own children, but all around us. In early Buddhism, it was considered, and it still is in many Buddhist cultures, that the ties of family, you know, being in a couple and raising children, are too strong, and that for the conditions for spiritual practice to be optimal, and that one had to leave all that behind and become a monastic to do true spiritual practice. But many, even in early times, both men and women would often take up monastic practice and ordain after living a life in the world and having raised a family. They would focus on their spiritual practice. But there were also those who were there were a number of well-known examples of lay practitioners, both men and women, who were revered as enlightened teachers who lived in the world and had families. So it's good for us to find out about them. Because in our world today, particularly in the West, there are many, many people who are living the world with the responsibilities of work and family, and who want to make a significant commitment to their spiritual practice and to meditate and to pay attention to their lives. And I think this is significant, very significant in the history of Buddhism, that there's this upwelling of lay practice. And I think it's in response to the to what the world needs. The world needs us to do that. The world needs people with these capacities, you know, with the mind of an elder, with the mind of joy, with the mind of spaciousness. So maybe it's this kind of parental mind that we can celebrate and aspire to on this Mother's Day, at the same time as we celebrate and honor the mothers of our personal family and other kinds of mothers who have mentored and nourished us along our way. And we'll also invoke Prajnaparamita, the mother of all Buddhas. So that's, you know, this mother, this source principle of all existence. As we chant, in a moment, we'll chant the Heart Sutra first, and then we'll chant the Hymn to the Perfection of Wisdom, and then the Metta Sutta, which is the Sutta on Loving Kindness, the practice of loving kindness. And we'll close our Mother's Day session with those. So, did I start this? Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for listening to my talk.
Every being and place, delusions are inexhaustible.